However, we're going to start the program today with our interview with Andrew Nobrega. So we're going to go straight to Andrew Nobrega talking about ecosystem services and valuing life.
So we'll be speaking today to Andrew Nobrega. He's the director of Ecovere Sustainability Consultants. And I met Andrew at a Green Drinks event, which is a local networking for environmental professionals. We actually interviewed Jim Lord, who runs the Toronto chapter of Green Drinks, although there are events all over the country in Toronto. And so I met Andrew at the last one that I went to, and we got into an interesting conversation about finance and biodiversity and all sorts of fun things like that. Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
Very well. And so you were telling me a little bit about some of the projects that you worked on, but I was just wondering if you could just introduce yourself a little bit further, just say sort of where you're interested in the environment came from and what sort of relevant experience you've had working with these sorts of issues having to do with biodiversity.
Okay. Well, let me start from the beginning. The passion that I've had my whole life has very much been focused on biodiversity specifically. So, you know, for a long time I wanted to be a vet. I was always a kid that was in the bushes looking for bugs. So it's something that really has carried through my whole life. But, you know, from a professional perspective, graduating from the University of Toronto with a degree in zoology, human biology, and environment, I came to work primarily first for Ecovere Sustainability Consultants, where I focused on green building and sustainable business management. And my focus in the industry has always been to conserve biodiversity and to try and identify where the levers are within the economy and within policy to try and enact that change. And initially it was very much, I saw the opportunities within the green building industry where there is such a demand for efficiency, there's a demand for more sustainable products to try and drive that to the industry and reduce demand on ecosystems where the biodiversity I care about exists. From there, I worked for 2 years with Ecovere in Toronto. I felt that I did want to connect a bit closer to nature, so I decided to go into my master's. So I went to Oxford University, where I studied for a master's in science in environmental change and management, with a strong focus on what we call biodiversity and ecosystem services. So this is a relatively new sector, and it's very much focusing on how do you approach financing biodiversity, not from a grant or philanthropy basis, but from an investment potential. So there's about an order of magnitude too little financing for our conservation needs globally. And by engaging the private sector and the investment sector into this space, it's hoped that we can leverage that and drive more funding for conservation efforts, mainly in tropical areas, but also including in the boreal forest, which is so important to Canada.
One of the things that I think would sticks with a lot of people is when you start getting into conversations about putting a price tag on and things like, you know, species or trees, and people with an environmental inclination tend to have a knee-jerk reaction to that. You know, you can't put a value on nature. But the idea that if someone doesn't do it, then essentially is assumed that it has a value of zero. Do you want to just explain your rationale behind putting a price on nature in that sense?
Yes, and you're definitely correct in the sense that most environmentalists do have a knee-jerk reaction to this approach. And fundamentally, if you're a timber company and you have the option to cut down a tree, that the value of that tree is equal to the timber they can get away from it, and there's no real externalities that you have to pay for associated with that. There may be some transfer costs of taxes, etc., but not any major costs associated with it. If I were a company that had this option, I have the... If we don't put a value on nature, it's equal to zero as it is infinity. If you know, I'm an environmentalist and I say that you can't put a value on nature because it's infinite, well, on a balance sheet, that is still a zero. Because if you can't put a number on that balance sheet, then it doesn't exist and doesn't combat the value of timber that the timber company is eliciting. So that's really where it comes into play, and I really do feel quite strongly that there has to be a concept of the value of nature in the economy or else it will never be considered.
The idea that there's externalities in the environment is something that is sort of alluded to but not really acknowledged in theory of economics. It's sort of considered not to exist because there isn't a number on it. And then in practice, because there isn't a number sort of established for, say, what the value of one, you know, blue jay is or something like that, or the services of a community of blue jays, is that to what extent would you say that these numbers are left off the balance sheets, as you were putting it, because it would be unfinancially advantageous for companies to do so, versus, i.e., intentionally left off because it complicates things, or B, they leave it off simply because no one has developed a number and that's a big job, and they're like, okay, well, we don't really know what to do with this, therefore we're just going to ignore it.
No, I think there's some convenience in the fact that it has not been included for those companies that benefit from it. But fundamentally, nature is incredibly complex. And this ties back to your query about putting a value on nature, is that it is very complex, and you will never be able to fully account for all aspects that nature provides us. That is a fact. But the question is it worth putting value on those aspects of nature that we can put a value on, even if we can't have a full evaluation? For example, if you look at a forest, right now there's metrics that allow us to provide a carbon value for that forest. It's actually quite simple. But it's more difficult when you get into other ecosystem services, which are those services that are provided to human society by ecosystems, such as water quality control, which, again, forests do have a contributing factor to. There's, again, another ecosystem service, which is the provision of habitat for pollinators like bees. One-third of all crops internationally are pollinated by bees. If bees aren't provided with the habitat they need or the conditions they need to exist, pollination goes down. That's a huge hit on the economy. So these are services that are fundamental and are coming from natural ecosystems such as forests, but they're very difficult to measure. They're very complex. And there are only some of those ecosystem services which we at this time can measure and can thus put a value on. So it's kind of this, do we go as high as we can in valuation? Do we have no valuation because it's impossible to completely value the system? This is the question that we really have to deal with.
And so just to make sure that everybody's on the same page with you, when you're talking about species and then ecological services or environmental services, this would be the idea of saying, well, it could be very arbitrary, and depending on what metric you want to use, you could come up with 10,000 different numbers for, the value, say, of a blue jay, of an individual bird. However, if you're talking about ecosystem services, this would be a case where bees was probably the best example, where you're talking about, okay, well, this isn't to say that the life of a bee is worth X amount of cents or X amount of dollars, but the value of bees pollinating plants, if we did not have the bees and we had to do this by mechanical means, would be $10 trillion, which, yeah. I've heard, obviously I'm making that number up for emphasis, but yeah. I've heard incredibly, incredibly high numbers, orders of magnitude higher than what it does with bees, for instance, if all the bees died out. And this is sort of what you're saying, is sort of one way that you can, on a case-by-case basis anyway, come up with some usable number to value a service provided by nature, even though you're not necessarily assigning a dollar value to the individual organism.
Exactly. And it really is... The concept of ecosystem service valuation should be very much focused on the services provided to human society as an ecosystem, as opposed to individual organisms. The type of valuation that you had talked about briefly is replacement value. You know, what would be the cost of providing that service to human society in absence? A really good example of this is if you were to destroy a wetland, what does a wetland provide? It provides very good water filtration. When you destroy a wetland, whether it's through development on purpose or by accident, you thus have to replace that service. In Toronto alone, we have a combined sewer system. So when there's a significant stormwater surge, a lot of the affluent that we would like to be filtered before it goes into Lake Ontario gets thrown right through the system because they have to open their floodgates. If you had more soft scaping within Toronto, whether that's green roofs, whether that's more wetlands, grassed areas, there would be a water management service that's provided by nature that would help to reduce the amount of stormwater going into these systems and help reduce this flow. That would be a free service if you just left it alone, allowed it to exist. But by putting down hard pavements, by putting down buildings, you're reducing the amount that this service can provide to human society, and thus you have to compensate, and this is the replacement cost.
Absolutely. So I think we could easily spend an entire double feature program analyzing the ins and outs of ecosystem services. I find it a terribly interesting topic of conversation. But let's come back to that perhaps another time. What I wanted to ask you more about today, now that we have sort of a gauge for what it is that you do and sort of where you're coming from on that, if you could just tell us a little bit about your experience when you went to the EU and the types of programs that they're using there to try and do this very thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just came back from the EU. I've been living there for the last 3 years, working both academia in the UK and then living in Luxembourg, working with some of the public institutions, trying to really kickstart this area of investment in biodiversity. And, you know, what are my experiences? Fundamentally, when you come back from the EU to Canada, you realize that the political structure within the EU really does affect the thought process is going forward with how they govern their society. The European institutions are broken up into a couple of main institutions, the European Commission, the European Parliament, and then many of the sub-institutions that influence it. But if you look at something like the European Commission, they're basically a very large think tank, which is not elected in, which has a long-term stance. Right now they're developing policies through 2020 that are saying, how do we create the best European society going forward, the most efficient European society going forward, the most environmentally efficient European society going forward? And this is something that when they come up with their dialogue, this isn't something that changes every 4 years with the political spectrum, as you'd see in Canada, you'd see in the States. But this is something where this will be a policy that affects them through 2020, and it will affect all of the member states. So what do you get? You get the ability to develop strong systems for carbon trading. You've seen this in the European Emission Trading Scheme. Whereas this has been a very tumultuous area in Canada, where we've seen political parties staging their platform on the existence or the non-existence of some sort of tax or trading system for carbon. In which case, after 4 years, that could also be reversed. In the EU, you don't necessarily see that. You may see that at the member state level, but the European public institutions allow for this overlying framework that drives directives down into each of the states that it governs, which mandates certain targets that must be met for the benefit of EU as a community. And it's really an interesting perspective on how to do this, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously there's some things in Canada that may be better than the EU, but I do really, from an environmental and a social perspective, enjoy this long-term planning.
And so you've outlined, I think, the main advantage there as compared to what sort of happens in Canada, having to do with the political system. And obviously a lot of that has to do with simply the way that the EU is set up. Is there anything, one of the things you highlighted there was the idea that it's not subject to kind of four-year political cycles. This is a larger body that not only is independent of that four-year cycle, but because it's more than one country, it sort of averages out specific countries' kind of local political issues or you know, other people that elect governments, for instance, for reasons other than the environment but happen mm-hmm. to care about the environment. This sort of counteracts for that. Is there anything else off the top of your head that you would say is an advantage to this system versus the Canadian system? And then are there any negatives? Is there anything about this system that you think doesn't work as well as Canada?
Well, I do think you get a strong strategic framework going forward. I think that's the big thing that it really does afford is you know, it allows you to look down 20 years down the line, where would we like to be? The EU is in the process of carrying out their 2020 strategies, and it's in the process of developing their 2050 strategies. All of these are slightly adjustable over time. Obviously, they have to change with circumstance, but they won't change with the agenda won't fundamentally change. They will be able to measure the progress and such and adjust it appropriately, but they will not change the goals of reducing carbon or promoting ecosystems or promoting relevant social benefits. And this is really a foundation of the strength of the EU in that sense. Obviously, they're having some other issues with financing, and you could argue that maybe the planning hasn't really worked there, but I think these are things that we've seen globally, specifically in Western countries, having difficulty over the last 4 or 5 years. Another important distinction about comparing North America versus the EU with regards to its environmental policy is to really focus on the fact that, first of all, they're resource-constrained and land-constrained. Second of all, they've had a lot of time to try and sort out these issues, whereas Canada and the U.S. haven't really had that pressure. They have more land, they have more resources, and they're newer economies. They haven't had to figure out as much stuff under as significant resource constraints. If you look at the UK, for example, they have a lot of difficulty maintaining their own food production for their population. They have to import a significant amount, whether it's from other parts of Europe, whether it's from Africa. Canada does import food. They wouldn't necessarily have to, though, and this is a big difference. Also looking at timber, Canada has an overabundance of timber, whereas the EU had to, at about 200 years ago, really strongly start to control their timber practices. And if you look at sustainable forest management in Europe versus Canada, they're light years ahead. Something that's not only a infrastructure thing from a political perspective or an economic perspective, but the fact is that 200 years ago, these guys had to make the decision that we're going to plant trees that can stay the course provide us with the ecosystem services we need, because they do have a concept of that, but also the timber we need for the next 500 years. So they planted the right species, they understand the right species, and they put together a portfolio of tree varieties that work in each circumstance really well. And if you go to Luxembourg, every single forest in Luxembourg, as far as I could tell, was sustainably forest managed, FSC certified or a similar certification. They were all also used for recreation. Most of them were used for other things like mushrooming and such. So the multi-use of these forests is a key development that they've had, and this is something that they've had planned and been using for hundreds of years out of necessity of a lack of resources. Canada is still in its infancy in terms of its resources. Yes, we may have issues with beetles in British Columbia that are reducing stocks there, but as a whole, Canada has a lot of timber resources. We have a lot of ability to create food resources. So we're not necessarily resource constrained, and you could argue that that makes us a bit lazy in terms of our environmental policy. The EU has had to, you know, pull up its boots and get into the dirt and try and figure out how can we make the most efficient use of our land to produce the resources that our large populations need. I mean, Germany has 80 million people in it, and it can fit into Ontario at least twice, maybe three times. This is a big difference, very, very big difference.
So we've outlined kind of briefly the sorts of reasons why you might want to undertake an analysis of ecosystem services. You outlined a little bit about your experience in the EU and the different conditions that have resulted in their current structure, which sounds like you're saying has a lot of advantages kind of over the current way that these issues are thought about politically here in Canada. So just with our last minute or 2 minutes here at the end, maybe if you could give a little bit of a case. I mean, if you were going to try and present and promote these types of ideas to the Canadian government in the political climate that we currently have here, what sort of argument could you make that you think would stick as far as bringing over some of those effective strategies and actually implementing them here in Canada? What sort of arguments would you give them that why this is in their best interests?
And, you know, fundamentally, it's very difficult. It's not impossible, but there's a reason that it hasn't carried the government already. And that is, you know, the things are looking pretty good for Canada from a resource perspective. We have a lot. We don't really have to worry about it. Yes, we have to manage about it. Most of our environmental management systems are focused actually on health and safety, human health and safety. I've seen a very good report that was published by EcoJustice, probably about 4 years ago, and it was presented at the Green Roofs for Healthy Cities conference in Toronto at the Toronto Botanical Gardens. And it focused on looking at stormwater management, which is a municipal requirement. It's something that falls under their control, and looked at what the value of adding green roofs in Toronto is to that. You know, looking at what infrastructure requirements would be needed to be updated for stormwater management and water quality control into Lake Ontario. In the current system, Ontario has very large water infrastructure needs going forward. They have to spend a lot of money in the future if they're going to keep it up to date. And they were able to juxtapose what investment in hard infrastructure — when I talk about hard infrastructure, I'm thinking engineered infrastructure with water filtration systems, new sewers, etc. — versus soft infrastructure, green infrastructure, as they call them in the EU, which is more softscapes, grassed areas, wetlands, green roofs, that help to absorb this water and control the amount going through the infrastructure in the first place. So reduce demand for capacity within the infrastructure for water in Toronto by increasing the amount of ecosystem services provided by an increased number of green roofs, more green spaces in general. And when you look at it from a cost perspective, it makes a lot of sense. And these are the types of things we have to do, is we have to provide options when a change decision has to be made. When it looks like an investment has to be made, you have to be able to look at the alternatives to those strategies. And by infiltrating these decisions, these change decisions, with options which include ecosystem service-based solutions, in many cases you can find that they are more cost-effective. And unfortunately, fundamentally, in many cases, that's what it comes down to, is what's the bottom line. If you can convince them that the bottom line is good for their economic bottom line, but also the environmental bottom line, there should be very little reason that they would turn it down. But these things take a lot of time, and I love my industry, I love what I do, I truly care about it, but I can't say it's not a frustrating industry to work in.
Well, that seems like a downer spot to finish, but I think there's a lot of good ideas there, and there's definitely a whole lot of people like Ecovera out there trying to work on these sorts of solutions. For now, I'm afraid we are out of time, but thank you very much for joining us today. Again, that was Andrew Nobrega, Director, Ecovera Sustainability Consultants. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.